Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. This is Marion Levant with Eleanor Bloom, interviewing Sophie Masloff, August 10, 1987. I'm going to ask some questions from the last time. What was your mother's full maiden name?
My mother's, nobody knows. She never knew either. I mean, she knew, but it had some kind of a foreign connotation because she was born in Romania. And we never could translate it into English. So we never knew what her maiden name was.
And what are the names of your brothers and sisters?
Well, I only have one sister living now. Her name is Sarah Choder, C-H-O-D-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a brother who's deceased. And I had a sister who's deceased.
Well, do you mind just giving us their name?
Sure. My brother's name was Morris Nyberg, N-E-I-B-E-R-G. And my sister's name was Fanny, F-A-N-N-I-E, Griglick, G-R-I-G-L-A-K. And they're both deceased now.
Right. And why did your parents fear for their lives in Romania?
Well, for many reasons. My mother came from an absolutely purely illiterate family with no education. They lived in a small town in Romania whose the prime industry was not a salt pit, but a pit that had some kind of acid in it that everybody worked with this pit. She also felt that if she married and had children, there'd be no advantages for them at all there. She knew that they'd never amount to anything. They couldn't go to school. They feared for, she told us many, many times that when the tax collectors came around, if they didn't have any money, they would take the pillows, they'd take candlesticks, anything that was in the house they would take. And it was just the most horrible existence. And so she came to this country as a young woman with my father, and then they were married there, but then they had no family till they came here under the most excruciating, harrowing conditions in a real boat that was just off the store. And of course, this was, I guess, now 80, 90 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She felt there were more advantages in this country. Shortly after she came, my father died, or after. She was here a short time. I was 2 when my father died, and there were 4 of us.
Mm-hmm. So they were married in Romania?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And neither one of them could speak or read or write English at all when they came. My father picked up a little education, but he died before I even knew him. My mother, the day she died, couldn't read or write or speak English, but with all of that, she bought a house, property, and raised all of us. And so she raised the 4 of us in the Hill District, and she paid every single bill with cash. She never had a checking account. When I was able even to walk, I used to walk down to the Fifth Avenue Bank on Fifth Avenue. It was called the Fifth Avenue Bank. And paid the bills with cash. Water and electric and gas, everything. She never paid a single thing. Never had a checking account, never had a savings account. But she was able to buy a house on the Hill District and raise the 4 of us.
Wonderful. Really marvelous.
Unreal.
Oh, could you tell us, were you active at that time? Did you go to the Ikes?
Oh, yes.
Yes, that was like the center of the...
Yes. It was really a place for immigrants and children of immigrants. My mother, of course, there was a lady at the settlement house whose name was Mrs. Heldman. And my mother went there every time she had a problem, or she didn't know what to do with us, or there was something that she felt we were too young to know anything about, because she had no one here. My mother only had one sister, and that came to this country with her, and she lived in another city. So that when my mother had a problem, she had nowhere to go except to Mrs. Heldman at the settlement house, and we used to drift over there ourselves. We lived in a house that didn't even have a bathroom, and so we used to go to the settlement for a bath every Friday. Plus, I learned to swim there. Nate Kaufman was my teacher, and Mrs. Pearl had a sewing class. And we all went there regularly. It did a tremendous job for the immigrants of that day.
Mm-hmm. What was it like during the Depression in the Hill?
Well, of course, when the Depression came along, by that time, my mother wasn't well. She was sick, and they were my two sisters were married by that time. My brother and I were home alone. But I always found a job. I was always able to find something, and for a long period of time, I was the sole support of the whole family, the whole house. But you could do more with a little bit of money. My mother lived in a house. She had the second and third floor rented, and she was always very, very frugal, even until the day she died. She always feared that tomorrow something would happen. She'd be sick, or one of the kids would be sick, and she wouldn't have money. So we starved today. And she was very, very frugal all of her life. Even after we all grew up and were working, she still wouldn't allow us to spend a cent, and she constantly chastised us. Too extravagant. We bought fresh bread, things that when yesterday's bread was just as good. And that always bothered me. The fact that, you know, when she could have lived then and maybe enjoyed her life, she was afraid to. It was so sad, really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sounds like a soap opera, doesn't it?
It sounds like my mother.
You never enjoy your life, ever.
Mm-hmm. What kind of responsibility did you and your siblings have in the home?
Well, I was the youngest, and my responsibility was to see, there was a grocery store on every corner in the Hill District then, and there was a fish store and a beach store and a produce store. It was my responsibility each day to go to the store and buy what we were going to have for supper that night. And in addition to that, when I came home, I took my school clothes off and hung them up. When my mother came home, she washed them and ironed them so I'd have them for the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But my sole responsibility then was to look after the house, do the shopping, because my mother went out every day. And then as I got older, when I started the high school, then I got a part-time job. I worked in a grocery store as a clerk when I was 13 years old. And then I went to summer school to catch up in high school, and I graduated from high school when I was 16 and went to work, and haven't missed a day since then.
How did you happen to become a volunteer for John King?
Because I needed a job.
But I mean, how did you find out about it? You know, it was...
We lived in the Hill District, and the alderman was a man by the name of John Verona. And I met him in the street one day, and I said, I need a job. My brother needs a job, and I need a job. And he said, well, why don't you go to Democratic headquarters and do some volunteer work? He said, there's no sure thing that they'll get elected, but get down there. So I did. I was working on Penn Avenue, making very little money. And I went in the evenings to Democratic headquarters, and I was only 16 or 17 years old. And there I met Governor Lawrence, and I met Mr. Kane and Mayor Scully, all these people who were the, up until that point, that was in about 1937, there were no Democrats anywhere, so that it looked like it was a losing fight. It looked like I was wasting my time. But the next election around, the whole city turned around, and everything went Democratic, and it's been Democratic ever since. But at that point, it was all Republican.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you became a Democrat mostly because you knew the alderman, and maybe your mother was a Democrat.
Well, I wasn't anything. I wasn't even old enough to vote.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, when I got my first job with the county, you had to be 21, and I was 18, and I said I was 21. For years, even when I finally left the county, nobody believed me that I was 3 years older than I said I was, because all my records had me 3 years older. But I was really born of necessity. I wanted a job for my brother. I wanted something better for myself. And having nothing better to do, I did volunteer work for the Democrats.
What was your first job then? What did you
do? Well, my first job was in the old county tax board, Board of Property Assessment and Review then, as a clerk. Then there was a vacancy in Commissioner Kane's office and his personal staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, and I was there a couple of years. And then there was a vacancy in Common Police Court. And I went there. And from there I moved around. I was a tip staff, and I was an investigator, then I was chief clerk. And I was there for over 30 years in the Court of Common Pleas, in the assignment room where all the cases originate in the Civil Division. And that really was a tremendous, tremendous job. So fascinating and so interesting. It came to a place where me, with only a high school education, was telling the lawyers what to do, where to go, because they all agreed that they knew law, but they didn't know where the attorney's office was.
What was your actual job? I mean, what did you do?
Well, I worked in the assignment room. That's the room where all the cases originate, where the lawyers come to pick their juries, where we instruct the jurors in their duties, where we check the pleadings of the lawyers before they go to trial. I did all of that for 30 years or more, until I came to... But during all of this time, while I was working in the courts, I had a profound interest in politics. I was very, very interested in politics, and I held every conceivable office in the political field.
While you were working?
While I was working in the courts. I went to conventions, and I was active in Democratic women's organizations, as well as the B'nai B'rith and the Hadassah and the Committee on Soviet Jewry and the Sisterhood of B'nai Mana. Mm-hmm. I always did on with all of that. I had a daughter and raised her.
Oh, there's so many questions then.
Story, you can always do what you want to do, and I found time to do everything.
First started then, what was the impression that you had of, like, David Lawrence and Kane, Commissioner Kane? How did you see them as a young girl?
Well, as a real young girl, I had a hero worship for both of them. Mr. Lawrence had a family, but he had no other love except the Democratic Party. He put everything ahead of that, and he was such a fair man. If something was good for the Democratic Party, he put everything else aside, his own feelings, his own ideas. And he was the first first leader in Pennsylvania who really did anything for women. The first woman councilwoman in Pittsburgh was at Mr. Lawrence's insistence. When he became governor, the first woman in the state office was Grace Sloan at Mr. Lawrence's insistence. And he really was a friend of the women, and I've always remembered that about him, because any first woman, and Genevieve Blatt, who became the first woman in the Commonwealth Court, was at his insistence. And Mr. Kane was a real kindly man, and I came to know him and his family on a personal basis. As a matter of fact, his daughter-in-law is still my friend. We've been friends for almost 50 years. But through the years, everywhere I went, and I met all the governors, I met all the political people all over the country. As I told you when you were here before, I went to every single convention, every single political convention. I've held all kinds of women's, the first Jewish woman in practically all of these things, because Jewish women, it was unheard of then. Now it's common, but then it was unheard of.
Is there any anti-Semitism?
There was some. I'm sure there was some down the line. But I accepted it as a fact of life.
Can you think of any situations that you might want to tell us?
Well, as I think I told you this before, my backers decided that I should be president of the Pennsylvania Federation of Democratic Women, it was a real WASP organization. I know they said behind my back that they would prefer that I didn't get it because I was Jewish. I know that was a fact. And with their hard, to this day, there aren't very many Jewish women in the organization. But outside of that, I think I stood up. But if it was any there, I ignored it. I pretended it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any stories or little anecdotes about any of the people that you know, like the mayors, perhaps?
Which mayor?
Oh, I know, there were so many. Can you think of...
Pete Flaherty, yes. Pete Flaherty was not one of my big supporters. But when I see him now, you think he was my best friend. But when I wanted to be, when I wanted to come to council, he was then mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't support me. He said that he thought there were others should have, but he didn't say why. Then after him, of course, came Kelly Jury, and we've been very, very good friends, and he's been very, very supportive. Kelly, Mr. Mayor Kelly Jury has been a great friend.
Can you think of any projects that you were especially proud of since you've been on council?
Well, one of the things, of course, is cable. Pittsburgh mm-hmm. would never have cable. Now, it sounds like a frivolous thing, but when I came to council, Pete Flaherty absolutely was against it. He said that it was a ripoff and people didn't need it. They were doing just as well without it. But so many people had problems, especially in Pittsburgh, with reception. And so many people said to me, gee, if we could only get some way to get better reception because of the hills and the rivers and the bridges. So I took it on as a project on my own and thought through. I let bids for it. And the original system that Pittsburgh has, which was which Warner Cable, where the franchise owned, was probably the best system in the whole country. To this day, it's the best system. They actually went bankrupt, trying to give the city everything that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then my committee on council is Parks and Recreation. And under Parks and Recreation comes Senior Citizens Projects.
Mm-hmm.
And I am so proud that while I've been in council, I've been able to open more and more senior citizen centers all over the city. Every time I have an area that doesn't have a center, I get on it right away. I go out and look around, see if I can find a location. The city funds them. We pay the rent and maybe supply 1 liter. And I have found when I've gone back, it's such a wonderful thing. There's so many people who have no place to go. Senior citizens especially. People love babies, but nobody cares about old folks.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. I'm there. And so I was so happy to be able to go around the city and find places for senior citizens. There are other things in the parks, of course, that I'm interested in because it's my committee, and I keep a pretty close tab on it.
Did you agree with Pete Flaherty when he turned the, I think it was the Friends of the Zoo, they had been taking care of the zoo, and he had the city take it over?
I thought that was wrong because there was no point paying for something when you got it for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to run the show, and he resented anybody else there. The zoo now is running very well, but I think it's costing us more money than if we had not had, if we had let the Friends of the Zoo operate it.
Yeah. I guess they felt sort of let down.
Sure.
As you have become older, do you see the people that that you first met years ago, do you see them in a different light?
Well, there aren't too many left, frankly, because I was young when I started, and they were older, and most of them are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I see them in a different light, altogether different light, because now that I'm there, where they were then, I can look back now and see how right they were. And that's why it's so hard to pass your wisdom on to young people. Because as I look back now and I think of the things that I did, and I think of the people and I think now how right they were, I should have listened or I should have taken advantage of their wisdom.
Can you think of any particular one you'd like to tell us about?
Well, I think always of Emma Duffy Miller. I don't know whether you remember Emma Duffy. She was a great Democratic woman's leader. She nominated, she seconded President Roosevelt's nomination. And we used to go to political meetings together. She was, as I said, a great, great leader and a great lady. And she always used to tell me, stick with it. Just stick with it. Don't let them get you down. And she was the one who gave me that.
Oh, yes, God grants me the serenity to accept things I cannot change. Yes, that's a good blessing.
Yeah, and so I always, every time I look at that, I think of her and what a great person she was. She was a great leader. But I had a lot of local people who were friends, a lot of them. I had, not only in the political, the political situation, the political thing changes. There's different committees, there's been different commissioners and different council people and all kinds of different political leaders.
That changes
all the
what
time.
They're interested.
All the time. Mm-hmm.
Who were the opposition to Oh, I guess that one.
Well, now, see, there wasn't much opposition. If you were a Democrat, you had a good chance of getting elected. Your opposition was within the Democratic Party in the primary election. If you won out in the primary election, then you were in, because there weren't Republicans in the city to speak of.
All right. Going back to the Common Pleas Court, can you think of the judges at that time and tell us anything about the judges?
Well, of course, then there were only 15 judges in the whole Court of Common Pleas. Now there are about 36. And when I went to Common Pleas Court, there was the president judge was a judge by the name of Rowan, R-O-W-A-N, a real wasp, strike lace. They just couldn't see anything good unless you were a wasp and a male, a white male. And I was under him because of his attitude, and I always felt that I was never going to get anywhere as long as he was president judge. He died shortly afterwards, and Judge McNaughton became president judge, and it was more of the same. But as the years went on, we started getting more liberal judges in the courts, and then I could make my case. Albasert became judge. He was extremely liberal. And then he started to realize that times were changing. It was time for women to be in better posts. And by that time, I had the 10 or 12 years of experience. And they kept moving up all the men around me. And he picked it up. And there were several other judges who then came on. Judge Sam Weiss was who came on as a judge at the time. Able to move ahead then.
Can you tell us anything about these men that might, like an anecdote or a story that would help us to understand them?
Not really. They were liberal judges. Mm-hmm. They knew that the time had come for women somewhat.
Well, what about the way they related to the people who came before them? The way they interpreted the law and carried it out?
Well, each judge was an individual. And some of them were a little more flamboyant than others. Some were hanging judges. Some, they said, would hang you if they could. But each one was so individual. But by and large, in all of my years in the courts, I found judges tried leaned over backwards to be fair. They weren't always, because after all they're human, but they did try very, very hard to be fair, and they were all kindly men, any that I've ever met. And of course I met several women. Judge Alpern was one of the judges. She lived across the street of me, and she was a wonderful person and extremely knowledgeable and very, very kind. And there were several other women judges, Judge Sofer, who had a big effect on my life because I found them to be role models. And the judges, the people in Allegheny County are lucky because we had a wonderful bench, and I think we still do.
Well, the idea of role model is very interesting. How did she act as a role model?
Well, she lived across the street, and she was a judge in the Court of Common Pleas. Before that, she had, I'm talking about Judge Alpern, she had been a city solicitor. She was the first woman ever appointed to a Supreme Court. She ran for election and didn't make it, and it was understandable because she was the first woman, and it was in a predominantly Republican state. So she stayed on as a judge in the Court of Common Pleas, and I had long heart-to-heart talks with her. And she was so brilliant. She was such a brilliant woman. Also, very compassionate. And I was just a kid and came from such a poor background and had really tough going all the time. And I looked up to her, and she sort of was sort of a guide. She sort of said, she'd take me and say, "Now don't do it. Don't do that. That's silly. What do you want to do that for?" She sort of helped me along.
Can you think of any particular incident?
Well, before I ran for council and was successful, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 years before that, I said to her, "They're asking me to run for council." And she said, "Don't do it. This is not the time. They're only using you. The party's only using you, and you will not make it this time. Don't do it. And I didn't. And it turned out that she was right, because if I had run that town, I would not have made it, because there was strong opposition.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things I remembered about, and several other things. There's so many things in life, you know, my life with my children. If I had a problem, she would advise me. One time my daughter was doing so poorly in school, and I was so upset, and she said, well, why don't you take her to a psychologist? And it had never occurred to me that maybe that would help.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I followed advice, and it was just the best thing that ever happened to me.
Oh. Do you have any comments about the people in city council that you've worked with?
None.
What are the most significant issues discussed in council, besides you mentioned cable?
My committee, of course, but every day there's something significant. Every day we spend millions of dollars every day on the city, and every day there are things that come before us that require action, building a new bridge, getting money, and of course the most important thing is the budget, which we the council is responsible for. That is very, very difficult. We work on the budget for 2 months, November and December. And that is what's very, very difficult. We must come up with a balanced budget by the end of the year. And each department head lays out their needs. And then we have federal funds. We have state funds that we can use for projects. The question is, which project is more important than the other? Which one do you choose, or who do you choose? Formal meetings twice, a finance meeting and a general meeting, and then we have public hearings other days. So there's something going on almost every day. And every day there's something going on somewhere that requires my attention. Somebody calls me on the phone with a problem they have, and maybe I spend a half a day trying to get it straightened out.
Can you think of a typical one?
Yesterday I had a typical one on Beachwood Boulevard. They wanted to tear up the street. And they want to do it from 9 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning, just to do the basic work. And then they would go on and lay a whole new street, and put a whole new street in. From the Homestead High Level Bridge down to around Forward Avenue, because it's in terrible shape. It gets a big beating, you know. Well, the neighbors up there screamed. They didn't want them working all night. And they were very unreasonable, because it was only one night, and the alternative to that would be not to do the street, because a contractor, see, the city gives contracts on the basis of the lowest responsible bidder. This man was the lowest responsible bidder on the basis that he would be able to do the preliminary work during the night, because he said he couldn't face up to traffic. And so because he was the lowest bidder and the lowest price, he got the contract. Well, this just happened this past weekend. And those people absolutely refused to bend, so they had the alternative of either not getting a brand new street and having a patch-up job, or putting up with one night of discomfort, if it would be discomfort. The contractor says it won't be so. That still isn't resolved, but I'm working like anything to try to get them to agree, because it's the only reasonable agreement. So I have all that right here. I'm still working on that, trying to get them to agree to allow them to do that one night.
That's
only one. But every day there's something else. Every day something comes up.
Can you think of another one?
Let me think, what did I have? Oh, last week there's in Highland Park. Highland Park now is used maybe 90% by minorities, by the blacks from Rymer Avenue. They go to Highland Park. There was only one large shelter in Highland Park where they could have picnics and things, and it was deteriorating. The mayor said there's no money to fix that up. And it costs a lot of money, $230,000. Well, I decided that we have to find the money, because I have to have a place. Those people have to have a place. I worked on that for weeks, and we finally have that going. We have a consultant, and by next spring they should have a nice big shelter. And then there's a lot of little things. The baseball teams need funding. Maybe $500, some poor team needs funding. It's a question, and that's my committee, because it comes under Parks and Recreation. I've got to find maybe $500 for them for bats and balls and things, you know. And almost every day there's some prize, something that comes up that I drop everything and work on. Plus, my routine things, I keep a close tab on Parks and Recreation. I watch the funding, I watch the activities. But in addition to that, every day there's something.
That sounds very interesting. Maybe if we have time at the end, you could tell us some more of these.
Oh, my gosh, there's so many things going every day.
Do you have any comments about the different presidents of council that you've worked with?
No, I think they've all been fine people. I hope to be president next time around in January. I'm afraid to think so, but I just might be. And that might come to pass. First woman, first Jewish woman, too, to be president of council.
Oh, that would be marvelous, especially as first
Jewish. We wish you luck.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The mayor's supporting me all the way. It's just a question of getting five of my colleagues to vote for me.
Well, we hope you have five good friends on there.
Thank you. I know I have four. I need one more.
You said that the leadership is not the same as when Lawrence was there. How does it differ?
Oh, so different. When Lawrence was the leader and the people that worked with him, he took an eye, as I said before, he was a completely unselfish man who worked just what was good for the party.
I wonder how much time we have.
It should be shutting off.
He tried very, very hard to even things out, to be sure that there was a good religious group and a good minority group. He tried to have everything even out. And everybody, most people, and his word was law. But he was a fair man. And if he said, this is what we're going to do, this is the way it was done.